I'm Christopher Lighton in New Delhi, at home with the legendary correspondent of the BBC in India, Mark Tully, knighted by the Queen of England, awarded the highest honors by the Indian government too. We're looking back 50 years and maybe about the same span ahead. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Mark Tully, I'm so happy to meet you. They can't say you went native in India because you were native in India. Born in the 30s in Calcutta in the last days of the Raj. Tell that wonderful story I've read of yours about how an Englishman in the Raj knew it was time to wake up and get going in the day.
Well, this is a story which was told to me. I can't say as a child I experienced it, but it was told to me by a man who was a dentist in the Indian Army. And he said, oh, it was wonderful life in India because you knew when it was time to wake up, you felt your chin, and if it had been shaved, then it was time to get out of bed. Well, you know, my real experience of the Raj is of what an isolated life, in a way, we lived as children in Calcutta. Because the whole aim of the Raj, at least in Calcutta, was that nothing should happen to us which would turn us into any way Indian. The great fear was that people would go what was called jungly. In other words, you'd lose your Britishness and become in some way Indian. And I remember my grandfather always used to talk about someone called Uncle Charlie. And he said, Uncle Charlie went jungly. He went up country and married a native, which, of course, was in those days, in the eyes of the Calcutta British Raj, one of the worst things that you could do. And I'll just give you one example. As children, we were positively discouraged from learning Hindi or Bengali, which was the language of Calcutta. We had a European nanny, and she had no work to do because there were so many servants. But her main job was to stop us becoming too friendly with the Indian ayah or the driver or anyone like that. And I still remember one occasion when I was sitting with the driver waiting for nanny to get in the car, and the driver was teaching me to count ekto, teen, cha. And nanny came in, she heard this happening, and she gave me a slap across the head and said, that is the servant's language, it is not your language.
My word. That goes against the legend, anyway, that the Brits really knew the people intimately and that they stayed for long tours. They knew the hearts and minds, unlike us Americans who come and bomb and leave.
Well, of course, there were Britons and Britons, and I was talking very specifically about the Calcutta European community, the business community in India. And certainly if you read the works, for instance, of Philip Mason with his wonderful books about the Indian civil service, many of the civil servants, especially those who stayed for a long time in a particular district, certainly did know their people and wrote gazetteers and things like that about them. But even they were positively discouraged from staying on afterwards. The idea was that you came to India, you made your career in India, but you always went back to Devon or Cornwall or Dorset, some really nice Englishy English county to retire in.
And they did after independence. They went home on a boat and never looked back. Why did you stay?
Well, I didn't stay. Of course, I mean, I came back again. I was sent back to school in England, and I didn't like it. I had much preferred my school in Darjeeling in the hills. It was a very free and easy school, and I went through all the traditional British public school situation. I went in the British Army for 2 years. I went to Cambridge, and there couldn't be a much more English university than that. And it wasn't until I joined the BBC and was thoroughly dissatisfied with the job which I had there, which was ironically not in journalism but in the personnel department, and a vacancy came up in Delhi. And I said, well, as I was born in India, perhaps I'm suitable for this job. And anyhow, I'd like to go back and see what India is like. So I decided to apply for the job. I got the job. And when I got back to Delhi, the very first day, I had this amazing recall suddenly it was the smell of the place particularly which brought the whole of my childhood ran through my mind like an express train. And from that moment onwards, actually, I just thought India would be have a special place in my life. I didn't realize then, of course, how special that place would be.
And surely it did. You've covered wars with Pakistan. You've covered assassinations, disasters like Bhopal. In a time of even grander kind of meta change, silly question, but name the biggest change in India in your time, or two or three, at the deepest levels.
Well, you know, I think one of the great big changes in India is there is a great deal more self-confidence in India now than there used to be. When I first came here, India was said to be living from ship to mouth because it was so dependent on American food aid. When I came here, they were very touchy about any suggestion of foreign interference or anything like that. They were very uncertain of themselves. There was a whole lot of questioning about the stability of India after Nehru left. Now, India, in my view, is almost overconfident. It is so self-confident that, in my view, it is actually failing to look at the problems that it faces. India really does believe that it's going to be one of the great economic superpowers of this century.
Take apart that conviction, which may be an illusion. What's wrong with it?
Well, there's nothing wrong, of course, with the increase in self-confidence. I'm really very happy about that. But what is wrong with this talk about being an economic superpower is, firstly, that it is based on one figure only, which is GDP growth. Now, GDP growth does not tell you who is growing. It just tells you that the nation as a whole is growing. And even then, we all know it's not a very accurate figure of that. The problem in this country is a very obvious one, which is still not being properly tackled. And that is that the economic growth is not getting down to the poorer people. Now, India is facing the problem or the advantage of having a very young population coming up. And we know that the young population can be a huge advantage in terms of their inventiveness, their willingness to take risks, their entrepreneurial skills, and all the rest of it that young people have. But at the same time, young people who are dissatisfied, young people who are not getting what they feel they should get, not getting jobs, not getting good education, not having opportunities, being under financial strain, being poor, those sort of people are tinder wood. They're the sort of people an explosion can be fired by. And that is the real danger in this country.
What kind of an explosion would it be? I keep puzzling about this myself. There's no simple equation of extreme poverty and visible unhappiness. People can seem quite content and miserably poor at the same time.
Certainly, and of course I think India had a tradition of that, and I think in some ways the whole caste system and the belief in karma, the belief in that, you know, in a way where you are now is part of, is you are fated to be there by what you did in your last life. These things actually do matter, they do count. But these pressures are now weakening. Caste doesn't have the same impact as it used to have before. People are no longer, more and more people are no longer prepared to accept this, the poverty. Another problem is, of course, that in the old days, the poor on the whole were scattered in villages all around the country. Now more and more of them are coming into the big cities, and more of them are living in slums and places like that, where explosions of violence and rioting can easily take place. And they do take place in India at present.
In the biggest and richest of the new cities, Bangalore, I was astonished to see that with the Infosys high-tech boom comes a slum boom, and nobody seems to have planned to do it any differently. 50,000 people at least living in a perfectly squalid, open, endless slum, you know, within shouting distance of huge new prosperity. And it's as if to say, well, that's the way it's done in India. Nobody seemed to have planned for the inclusion of the service population, the barbers, the drivers, the cleaners, in the new game.
Well, you know, I'd say two things about that. Firstly, I'd say, and I say this publicly in India, one of the strange things about India is it is, in a way, a very open country. I mean, I'm a foreigner, but I go around being very critical of India. I've been very critical of India in my books. I mean,
well, you're Mark Tully, and they listen, I know.
But I have a lot of positive things to say about India, but certainly negative things. Now, so one of the things I've said time and again, and I've said this to business people, and it seems to me that, yes, there are exceptions, but on the whole, the business community in this country has a huge, two huge advantages. A, they are prospering in a big way. B, they have a big clout with the government because the prosperity, the growth and everything basically depends on them. Yet they are not shouting, they are not raising their voice against the standards of governance in this country. And that leads me on to my second point. It's not just a question of planning for slums. The real problem lies in the government's inability to implement what it plans. You will find there are plans for Delhi, and look at the plans, you look at the plan, you go and see what's happened on the ground, and it's a completely different thing. There's a wonderful expression I found in a paper written by an American academic, I think he was, who was with the World Bank once. He described in India, he was with the World Bank in India, he described India as a flailing state.
Yes.
And that is a very good expression, because the government is flailing. It passes laws, it makes plans, everything is looking wonderful on paper. And as he said, at the top of the government, you have some of the brightest people in the world, you know. To get through the Indian Administrative Service exam and be an elite administrator in this country, well, the competition is phenomenal to get there. And yet they sit in their office going through their files, drawing up plans and all the rest of it. And then they issue the orders for these plans to be implemented. And what happens? Well, the implementation is very, very poor indeed. There's a famous saying by Rajiv Gandhi, you know, that if he wanted to give 100 rupees to a development scheme in a village, he would be lucky if 15 rupees of that 100 rupees was actually spent in the way it was meant to be spent.
Wow. Will you take apart this slogan that's true in many measures, but everybody uses it without quite knowing it, the largest democracy in the world? Up close, it has so many more qualities of a Nehru monarchy that simply can't break the habit of that family.
Well, I think India is a democracy. India changes governments. Indira Gandhi was the most powerful of all the Nehrus, actually, at the height of her power. And yet she called an election, was defeated, and stepped down. And I think one of the most significant things which people often forget about Indian democracy, and one of the most important things about a democracy, is not who wins, but who loses and how they behave. Because you look around the world, and time after time after time, you have an election, and the defeated party does not accept it and creates trouble, violence. Kenya is just one fairly recent example of that. So in one way, India is definitely a democracy. It's also a democracy in that there is, as I said earlier, a great deal of freedom of speech. We have a very free press, free electronic media as well. Where it is not a democracy is because it is too easy for corrupt people to get hold of government money and indeed government power. The institutions of this country are not strong enough. They do not stand up for their rights. They don't protect the poor or the disadvantaged when they come to them and seek for protection. It's an institutional problem, the problem of democracy in this country. And this, in a way, is why the Congress is the Nehru Gandhi has been able so much to grab hold of power and hold on to it. Because when they're there, somehow or other, all the institutions collapse in front of them and say, what you wish, madam, or what you wish, sir, will be done. And therefore, the politicians also within the Congress Party say that. It's also to do with the fact that the Congress Party itself is convinced that without the Nehru Gandhi family there, the party will fall apart. And it is very interesting.
Is it a sound fear? Is it true?
Well, they would point to what happened in 1996. We did have a period of Congress government after Rajiv's assassination, and I would say a very fruitful period of government myself under a very astute politician called Narasimha Rao. But after that election, the Congress, when that government was over and elections came up, the Congress did start to fall apart, and it was only when Sonia Gandhi took an active role in it that it pulled together again. So there is evidence to suggest that. And it's very interesting that there is no, that I know of, memorial to Narasimha Rao in Delhi. Congress has done nothing to commemorate him. Recently, there was the 90th birth anniversary of him, and Congress did nothing to commemorate him at all. It's almost as if they want to wipe that chapter of their history out.
Mm. Mark Tully, what about state government, where so many important services, even schools, get delivered? The line we keep hearing is that they vote the bums out every 5 years, no matter who's in, and wait for another 5 years to vote the new bums out, without ever feeling anything like a sort of popular sovereignty or that their wishes will be heard.
No, you see, one of the things about democracy in this country, which I think was well put to me by an MP who just lost his seat, who was actually a very prominent member of the BJP. And he said, I lost my seat because I was not a good facilitator. And actually, politics in voting in India is all about facilitation. And what did he mean by that? That people, on the whole, vote for people who they feel will do something for them. That is it. They don't vote for them on principle or anything like that. So that, for instance, is why people will vote by their caste, because they'll think that if a man of my caste is elected, he will do something for me. And you see, they don't have any confidence that the government will do anything for anyone without a political input. And that's why, time and again, you find that people are actually voting for people on the basis that they think that person will be able to do something for them.
What's changed in caste, which is hard for a short-term visitor to observe?
Well, one dramatic change, of course, has taken place is that, in a sense, the power now lies with the poorer people, because the poorer castes are in larger number than the upper castes are. And you have a striking example of that in the fact that in India's most populous state, Uttar Pradesh, the chief minister is not only a Dalit, a former untouchable, but a woman as well. And of course, there could hardly have been more oppressed or downtrodden people in the earlier days than Dalit women. So politics has changed the equation. But at the same time, in a sense, it has tightened the bonds of caste, because people do tend, especially in northern India, but not just in northern India, to vote by their castes. But another thing which has changed is that although you still get cases of oppression of Dalits, untouchables, and lower caste people by higher caste people, on the whole, this is far, far less than it used to be. And recently, I was talking to a very prominent Dalit, a distinguished economist who sits on the central government's planning commission. And he was saying how he saw the Dalit community, untouchable community, as a community of aspirants now. He said you go into any slum in Bombay or any village and you'll find that Dalit children are among the keenest ones to get education, to work and that sort of thing. And I said to him, yes, but we still get these cases. And there's been one recently only about 60 miles away from Delhi, of attacks on Dalits, particularly in rural areas. And he said, yes, but he said two things. He said, one, they are much rarer, and two, the Dalits retaliate now. And so...
Retaliate how?
Well, they fight back. There are clashes between the two of them now. These are big changes. But caste is still a major factor, and you only, as you say, have to see the newspapers, and you'll see even in the English language newspapers, which really are read by the most prosperous section of this society, you will see that people advertise for marriages on a caste basis.
Speak about things that don't seem to change entirely, and that is the Muslim-Hindu tension.
Well, my view of the Hindu-Muslim tension is that it is basically, to quite a large extent, a political thing rather than a religious thing. And time and again, when riots occur, you find that behind them there is either a political or an economic reason. By economic, I mean that some slum landlord might have a Hindu slum, and he might want to extend it, so he wants to drive off the Muslims who are living in the next door slum. And I've seen cases like this. And so he creates tension between the two, and the Muslims get driven off. But again, I would say that on the whole, these are isolated incidents. I would say that on the whole, there is no great, no huge tension between Hindus and Muslims. What is unfortunate, though, is that there is a growing tendency, I think, for Muslims to live in separate areas. There was always this tendency to some extent. But let me just give you two examples. Example number one is you consider what's happening in Europe. All this furore about burqas and France now banning burqas and all this furore about Islam and the dangers of Islam and everything. You know from walking around this country, there are Muslim women wearing burqas, there are Hindus with marks on their foreheads. Yes. You can occasionally see a Christian priest wandering around in his cassock.
Yes.
It would be unthinkable in this country to have the sort of furore which is going on, because this this country has centuries of these religions living side by side with each other. But the important thing to realize is that these centuries are based on an idea, not that you want to have some great soup whereby everyone says, well, actually Muslims are almost the same as Hindus, and Hindus are almost the same as Christians, or everyone has to be mixed up in a great soup of Americanism. Everyone has to be an American. No, the idea is very much that you are a Hindu, I am a Christian, I'm very happy to be a Christian, I'm very happy for you to be a Hindu, please don't interfere with my religion and I won't interfere with yours. And the British realized this, and this was one of the reasons why the British were always very suspicious about Christian missionaries, for instance. On the whole, the wiser British people didn't like them because they were doing the opposite of this. They were saying to Hindus, you're stupid to be a Hindu, or it's foolish to be a Hindu. So for those reasons, I think that basically there is a religious stability in this country. And just one last point. You know, when the most sensational example of religious tension probably was the pulling down of the mosque in Ayodhya by Hindu extremists back in 1992, when Hindu extremists attacked a mosque, which they said stood on a sacred Hindu site, and pulled it down. And after that, all the Western media were saying this is the end of secularism in India, and people were saying that India's going to be like Cyprus at the best, or Northern Ireland, or the Balkans at the worst. And whenever I was asked this question, I would say simply, well, I don't think it's going to go like that, because I've seen in India that these sort of things flare up very quickly, but flare down again very quickly too. So I'm not a believer that India faces a huge problem of Hindu-Muslim tension.
And what of Hindutva and the BJP, Hindu nationalism? It's our country with a vast majority, this kind of possessive politics in the years ahead. Or has that crested? Is that over?
My feeling is it has crested. That's what I think. I think they're searching for an issue. And I think the BJP, which is the Hindutva Party, is basically now trying to position itself more in the center. Because they realize that the Hindutva agenda only appeals to a limited number of people. After all, what are they talking about Hinduism? Hinduism is the most varied religion in the world.
Mm.
There are huge arguments about whether you could even call it a one religion. One scholar has called it like a great banyan tree, and you know banyan trees spread out by putting shoots down, and you get a huge area of ground covered by all these shoots. And it said it's like a banyan tree where there is no center any longer, but all the shoots are still alive and kicking. It's a hugely varied religion. And so Hindutva only appeals to a limited number of people. And Hindutva, I think, also has lost some of its appeal because of what I said earlier about self-confidence. When people thought that were fearful about India's future, thought India's unity was in danger, that sort of thing, then they saw the outsider as the enemy, and then something like a very strong form of nationalism became attractive. Now, I'm not saying this has disappeared, but if you look at the years of the BJP in power, they did nothing to implement their main core issues, the main Hindutva issues. They didn't succeed in building a temple in Ayodhya on the site of the mosque that had been pulled down, which was one of their key issues. And only the very day we're talking, there is a story in the paper today, again, about how someone from the BJP has said, we realize that we cannot necessarily address what they call their core issues because we have to be allies with other parties who don't support those issues.
Mm. The other big rolling story, and I wonder what you think of it, in India while we're here, is this whole question of a confrontation with the tribal people, the Naxalites, sometimes called or manipulated by the Maoists in eastern India. It seems in the chatter we take part in, much closer to a kind of political resolution. Nobody seems to want to go to an air war or even a ground war with these people. Can you see an outcome there?
I think it is possible. If you take India's record of dealing with other militant movements, particularly in the northeast, it is possible that they could start talking. But I think that there are two problems, really. There are divisions within the Naxalite movement. And what is the government going to offer to the Naxalites? You see, we come back here to this problem of a flailing government. The government can say to the Naxalites, yes, we're going to bring schools, we're going to bring educational opportunities, we're going to bring health centers, we're going to give you job opportunities and all the rest of it. But the Naxalites will look at the government's past record in those areas of doing that, and they'll see that nothing has happened, you know. And then there are also very tricky issues over land rights, because, of course, where the Naxalites are most strong, very often in areas which have very valuable mineral deposits, coal, iron ore, those sort of things. Now, the government wants to exploit these, but the government's record of resettling people who have been taken off their land in order that it can be developed is abysmal on the whole. So if I was a Naxalite, I'd say, well, how can I trust you to redevelop this? But certainly I think there is an awareness in the government among some people that simply trying to send the police in and stop this problem through that is not going to work. And it certainly won't work unless there is a radical retraining of the police force and rethinking about the strategies that they use. Because at the moment, you're really sending a crude, old-fashioned police force, which is much more used to controlling riots and hitting people on the head with lattes or staves than coping with what is, in effect, a guerrilla war.
What do you make, Mark Tully, of this virtual alliance with the United States? With some restraint in Afghanistan, but for the future, it seems an almost across-the-board identification of American and Indian military interests.
Well, I think there is a certain coming together of those interests, but I think what is important to realize is that India knows very well that it cannot come too close to America without causing problems in its relationship with China, which it does not want to cause. And I think sometimes America expects more of India than India is going to be able to give. And another problem is that unless this is clearly seen by America and indicated as a relationship of equals, then all the nationalism and all that, which there is in India, will start bubbling up. And there are a lot of people in this country who are anti-American. There is no doubt about that. There is a political constituency in that.
What does it sound like nowadays?
Well, in part, the basic reason of it, the most common cause of it, is really that America is seen as a threat to Indian culture, and that people fear that India is going to be Indian-Americanized, and this will be a threat to American culture. The other reason, of course, is the fact that people look around the world, and America has not always been exactly subtle in its dealings with countries which are clearly weaker than it. And there is obviously a fear that America's ultimate aim actually is to dominate this country.
And what's the pro-American rejoinder?
Well, the pro-American rejoinder is that America is a very valuable ally, that India lost a tremendous amount by the bad relationship they had with America during the Cold War and for some time thereafter, that put India and America together, and that you have a far greater strength than you have with India on its own. In particular, America can put pressure on Pakistan, and India looks to it to do that. So these are some of the reasons why there is a lobby for the American. I wouldn't call it alliance. I think that's a dangerous word to use. I think you have to say it's a relationship.
Which they'd love to be a partnership. That's the buzzword I've heard a lot.
I think partnership would be coming too close. For my reading of the situation would be that this would soon lead into complications with China, and into people here thinking India is the junior partner.
Interesting. Speak about that cultural invasion on all these flat-screen televisions that are bringing Jim Carrey and Arnold Schwarzenegger into every Indian living room that can afford it. What is the confrontation here? How do Indians talk about it?
Well, Indians talk about it, of course, in terms that consumerist. And all these, one of the most obvious signs of this is these shopping malls, which are coming up everywhere. And you know, it's interesting, India is now a shopper's paradise. But for many years, people like me, when we went to England, we would buy a lot of things because we couldn't get them here. And you know, when I first came to India, there was such a shortage of consumer goods that diplomats leaving the country could even find a market for a second-hand lipstick or second-hand underwear. Well, now you go around the shopping malls and actually you realize you'll get everything you want and probably cheaper here. But this, of course, is seen as an American-type situation coming here, and it's seen as bringing consumerism. And Indians like to think of themselves as people who believe in balance and do not believe that you should go overboard for property or anything like that. They believe in self-control. And so they see consumerism as one of the great sort of enemies. And then, of course, they see what they regard as vulgarity. They see the way, the incredible way, this is a big change. Girls now in this country almost more of them wear jeans than don't. Mm. Well, to a traditional Indian, that is a vulgar form of dress. They see American, what they see as American vulgarity in modern Bollywood films, in the much more open expression of kissing and other such things as that, as happens in Bollywood now. They see, I think, American culture, they see Indian culture as a sort of restrained culture, sophisticated culture. They see American culture, I'm not saying they're right, I'll never be allowed back in America after this interview, probably, but they see American culture as garish, vulgar. That's what they're afraid of, I think.
And what about the sexual presentation? Sexy women, sexy men. Indians, I mean, the home of the Kama Sutra and those erotic temples, seems a little bit shocked by all this overt sexuality.
Well, I think that people are, many people are shocked by this. Most Indians still believe, for instance, in arranged marriages. I think there's no doubt about that. And so they would not agree with sex before marriage or anything like that. There is a very restrained element in Indian sexuality, which I've always thought of as unnatural to the basic traditions of Indian sexuality, which is really much more open, as you see in the Kama Sutra and in the erotic temples and in some of the other writings back in the heydays of Hinduism. Now, some people blame this restraint on Islam. Some people blame it on Victorian sexuality and the type of morality that the British brought with them.
There seems to be a compulsion today to talk about reimagining India, the new India, an Indian century. What do you make of the old and new in this transition?
Well, my view is that India is like, I wouldn't like to say like the tortoise quite, but that India is a country which goes forward slowly and steadily. I see what I might call, yes, a multiplying factor as the economy gets bigger and bigger, obviously. You know, the Rolling Stone does actually gather more and more moss, and so the economy gets bigger and bigger, and that does happen. And I see a very bright future for India, provided, as I said, they can improve the standard of governance, they can get the government out of a whole lot of things. One of the whole problem in this country is the government tries to do far too much. If the private sector and civil society can be left freer to do many more things, if the private sector can wake up and start putting pressure on the government to improve the standards of governance, then I see a very bright future for India. Because one of the things about India, which no one can deny, is the tremendous human capital that there is in this country. Indians seem, for some reason I don't fully understand, to be very bright people. And you in America know, for instance, you go around every university virtually and you'll find the professor of economics is probably an Indian there. At least that's what it seems to me sitting here.
A big bank chairman too.
Yeah. I mean, just only yesterday there was a picture in the papers of an American who has been put on an American of Indian origin, who has been put on one of Obama's prime think tanks. So I think that given the initiative, given the entrepreneurial skills which India is now showing, given the intellectual capabilities, given the fundamental religious stability in this country, I think it has a very bright future, provided it can solve this problem of governance. And instead of a flailing country, it can become a country which is moving steadily forwards. But it's a dangerous country to try and move forward too fast, I think.
Mark Tully, it's such a pleasure to sit in your beautiful living room and hear a tiny piece of what you know.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me. I've enjoyed it very much indeed.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Paul McCarthy, Ben Mandelkern, and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.